and the fancy Dan cosmopolitans of Moscow City and Moscow region and St. Petersburg, you know, basically they are getting out of doing the heavy lifting. We out in the provinces, we in the outlying republics, we're actually having to do all the hard work, and that means grunt work and blood work. And this, I think, will contribute to an issue that I've talked about in the past, which is precisely that as the Putin system becomes more and more under pressure, as it becomes, to be frank, much more exploitative over the regions, increasingly we're going to see a pushback. And this pushback will not be overt, because you still can't challenge this overweening state. It will be, as in late Brezhnevism, a covert one, in which actually local cabals of officials and business people and even security figures, aware that Moscow is now an increasingly distant, distracted and exploitative force, not expecting that Moscow is going to provide them with any real benefits in the future, instead conspire to cheat Moscow, to pad the figures, to claim that they need more, to claim that they can provide less. I mean, this is what tends to happen in this huge, diffuse, disparate country, is actually the control mechanisms become themselves corrupted, and that essentially locals will do their best to look after themselves in those times in which Moscow seems both distracted and also predatory and exploitative. And again, this is how the war will play out and mobilize. It's another example of how Moscow makes stupid decisions and expects us to pay for it. Well, we're not going to put up with that. And that leads me on to the second point, exactly this notion that the war becomes an example of the fact that you're being governed by the corrupt, the incompetent, and the, quite frankly, past their sell-by date. Because, after all, let's be honest, just as with Afghanistan, it's very hard for the Russians plausibly to think that there's going to be some kind of victory coming out of the war in Ukraine now. At best, you think you'll be able to find some way of salvaging something that you can spin as a success, but which is clearly in no way matching the cost of how this has been bought. But more broadly, it means that the leadership finds itself with no easy or possible answers. I mean, look, I don't think for the moment that Putin is looking for an out. I would love to believe so, but no, I mean, I think he's convinced himself of two things. One, that this is politically existential for him, that if he does not manage to secure something that looks like a victory, then he is seriously at risk. A feeling that has probably been, deepened by Prigozhin's mutiny. But the second thing is a belief, a hope, a desperation to believe that just over the horizon there is the fragmentation of the West and its will to continue to support Ukraine. Therefore, if he hangs on, there is a chance for that kind of victory. But let's say there is some kind of epiphany and he realizes that that's not going to happen. Well, even then, can he just pull out now? I mean, in theory, absolutely. And on the one level, you think, well, who on earth would actually resist that? But he must be aware precisely of the degree to which there is now a nationalist flank that is looking at him with suspicion. And the very reason for crackdowns, for example, the recent arrest of Igor Girkin, known as Strelkov, who for so long had been able to be very critical of the war as a whole, the war effort, how it's prosecuted, the specifics of, you know, Defense Minister Shoigu, whom he dubbed the plywood marshal, but also, unlike, for example, Prigozhin, Putin himself. I mean, yes, Strelkov Girkin had been particularly directly criticizing Putin right before his arrest, but even before then, I mean, his repeated use of the term "our unique strategic advantage" for Putin was so obviously deeply tongue-in-cheek that, you know, there was no question but what he felt. But the point is, for so long, Girkin had been given latitude, in my opinion, precisely because there was an awareness that he, in some way, spoke for such a large proportion of people within the sort of middle ranks of the military and the security apparatus. And so there was a desire, firstly, to give them a pressure vent, secondly, better not to actually drive them all underground, but thirdly, better also not to actually annoy and alienate the people who ultimately you depend upon for your own security. But so they finally decided, nope, this is too dangerous. We actually have to start rounding up the most outspoken critics of the regime. We'll see how far it goes. But again, I mean, I think it does show that Putin himself is now aware that he can't take the nationalist flank for granted. So how could he actually pull out of this? Again, this is where we go back to the Afghan parallel. I mean, even Gorbachev, who years before had concluded that this was a stupid war and needs to be ended, even before he was General Secretary and could actually really see the full impacts. But even so, Gorbachev had to operate within a political system in which he had to build some kind of, however grudging, consensus within the elite that the withdrawal had to be done. And therefore, we had the irony that, in fact, the first year or so of Gorbachev's time in power saw, if anything, an escalation of operations in Afghanistan. What Gorbachev had to do was more or less give the generals free rein. Say, OK, fine, try and win this war or get us to a place where it looks as if this is winnable. And it was only after they had, you know, bombed and shelled and so forth to their heart's content, was it possible for Gorbachev to not only turn to them and say, you see, this is not going to be a war we can win. And let's be honest, there were also many within the military who fully understood this. But also he could turn to the political leadership and say, look, I gave it a go. And yet we're no closer to victory, therefore we have to extricate ourselves. Now, Gorbachev was operating, obviously, in a very different political context. He had a razor-thin, or indeed arguably artificial, majority within the Politburo and the Central Committee, but also the Communist Party had its own rules and structures, which meant that Gorbachev could be toppled by something short of, you know, essentially a coup. But still, the point is that one of the key assets that Gorbachev had was that precisely he could say, this was not my war. He could say that to the Soviet people, but he could also say to Western interlocutors with which he had to deal, because this is the thing. Ultimately, the West had to help Gorbachev pull out of Afghanistan. The West could have turned around and been incredibly punitive and bloody-minded and said, no, you want to pull out and end this what Gorbachev called bleeding wound, then, you know, just do it. But instead, the West worked with him to provide him with the sort of kind of security guarantees, which in effect provided him with a political fig leaf, so that he could say, look, we went in, you know, arguably it was a bad move, but nonetheless, we did some good things, we built roads and schools, and we stopped anarchy from breaking out. Whatever narrative he wanted to use. And the West was willing to provide some way in which actually there could be a deal, so that, and the hope was this, the regime that followed the Afghan withdrawal under Babrak Karmal's successor, Dr. Najibullah. And again, you always have to wonder, Dr. Najibullah had previously been head of the Khad, which is the Afghan secret police, the Afghan's answer to the KGB. What makes a medical doctor join a very brutal secret police force? You know, one has to have some notion of, shall we say, the specialities he brought to bear. He was actually a quite ruthless and effective leader. And ironically enough, his regime, although it didn't last long, it actually did manage to outlast the Soviet Union. But still, again, it was about providing that kind of appearance of not peace at any price, but that a deal had been struck. This is, I think, going to in due course be crucial about Ukraine. Not, I think, in terms of the initial sort of end of the shooting war, but, you know, a long-term lasting peace, which will also address all the various other ways that Russia could, if it chooses, mess with Ukraine. I think it's very hard to imagine that being concluded while Putin is still in the Kremlin, not least because he's such an unreliable interlocutor. Just look at the grain deal. But also beyond that, simply because he clearly does not believe that Ukraine has a right to be a sovereign nation. So this is why I think a true peace will almost invariably mean a post-Putin peace of some kind. Third area I want to look at is essentially social crisis. I mean, again, with Afghanistan, you know, given the scale of the deployment wasn't so huge, a lot of the talk about a so-called lost generation was deeply overblown. But nonetheless, there was an issue here. The Afghansi, the veterans of that war, you know, did come back facing not just a considerable degree of social pressure, veterans of wars that are lost tend, unfortunately, not to be treated kindly in any society. But also, you know, the sheer lack of resources. In fact, this was a collapsing Soviet Union. So they were meant to have all kinds of privileges, particularly the ones who've been wounded. And yet, they couldn't get them because of corruption, because of scarcity. I remember once talking to an Afghan veteran, who had no legs. Basically, he had been in a BTR, armored personnel carrier, when they ran over a mine. And he was dragged out, but unfortunately his legs stayed behind. And, you know, he basically obviously needed prosthetic limbs. He has legs down to about the knee. And he was saying, he had these prosthetic limbs by the time I met him. But he was saying that at first when he was told that, yes, his prostheses are ready. So he went to the hospital to have them fitted. And the doctor said, no, I can't do that because you haven't given me a certificate to say that you don't have legs. And he pointed at his stumps and said, well, here you go. No. Sorry, need a piece of paper. Now, clearly this was actually essentially an opportunity to try and extort a bribe. He was a, you know, son of, I'm trying to think, train driver? No. Tram driver, I think it was. Anyway, so he didn't have the money. Fortunately, he had friends, fellow Afghansi, who basically sort of, manhandled him into the back of a larder, and they went off and found a doctor who was going to charge less. He'd still charge, though, to provide some little spravka, some little piece of paper that said, yes, this person has no legs. Then they had to take him back to the hospital, and he got his, frankly, very ill-fitting and not working very well, but nonetheless, his prostheses. And this was being recounted to me in a depressing sense of normalcy. You know, this is not something that was outrageous. It was, you know, as far as this guy was concerned, I mean, this is the way it is. No wonder that so many Afghansi did end up being, you know, feeling thoroughly alienated. And we had the issues of drug use. A lot of them had been exposed to opiates while they were in Afghanistan and brought it back home with them. It's worth noting that even today, the Russian Federation has a catastrophically high level of heroin use. They brought back a general sense of anomie, of social dislocation, of just not feeling part of mainstream society. For some, that just meant dropping out. I mean, obviously, look, most veterans adjusted and adapted and got back. But we're talking about the minority. And for some of that minority who felt cut off from the mainstream society, we saw them drifting into criminality, and particularly violent criminality. I mean, this is a problem. You have, you know, relatively young men. In many cases, they become, to a degree, slightly sort of adrenaline junkie. They have become not just sort of combat scarred, but they're combat trained. What is the one skill that is in demand that they bring back with them to Civvy Street? It is precisely that the will and the capacity to use violence. And therefore, this was, after all, a time of rising, the emergence of organised crime within the Soviet Union. So Afghansi became disproportionately involved as enforcers, contract killers and the like for this new brand of organised crime, contributing to its, you know, the violence on the streets. And even, frankly, the Afghan veterans movement became in some ways, in some aspects, almost an organised crime phenomenon itself. As a way, I mean, this particularly happened in the 1990s, but, you know, actually they were given a whole variety of perks in order to raise money, such as, for example, being able to carry out certain imports without paying the same dues on it, which is one of the reasons why we had the spectacle of senior figures within the Afghan veterans movement being assassinated in contract hits to take over this privileged way of being able to import goods. So this is what happened with Afghanistan. Again, I would stress, this is what happened with a 0.35% participation rate, which Russia has already attained. And, you know, think about this. The enemy was a result of two things. One was a lack of resources, and Russia is going to lack resources and likely will continue also to not privilege the veterans. Despite all the grand talk about how well they're going to be looked after, we're already seeing that veterans are not getting what they're entitled to, whether it's because of incompetence, penny-pinching or corruption. This is likely to continue or actually get worse. But secondly, anomie, that sense of being alienated from your society and the values it's meant to instill. There's all this talk about the glories of the war and Russians standing up and demonstrating their selflessness and their heroism. And how does that compare with the reality? With the reality of officers who bug out at the first threat and but expect you to continue to sit there shivering in the trenches as cluster bomb munitions rain down around you. Of failing to get anything like the kind of logistics, food and medical attention which you're meant to get. You know, all of these things in a war that you still don't really understand what the hell it's all about. When frankly, as far as you're concerned, you thought that your Ukrainians were basically your brothers. You know, put all this together, and again, we have a recipe for a similar, pretty substantial sort of wave of social dislocation. And in a future podcast, I'm going to drill down a little bit more directly on precisely what's happening with the organized crime scene. But one thing that's already noteworthy, which again, I think the next generation of, shall we call them, Ukraintsi, veterans of the Ukrainian war, are going to contribute to, is the pressure on the current underworld status quo, precisely from what we could think of as insurgent gangs, the ones that are less involved in long-term partnerships over illicit markets and deals with corrupt local officials and things, but essentially the ones that are feeling violent, outsiders with least to lose. We have groups like the AUE, which is particularly a kind of youth prison subculture, which is now emerging outside the prison system. And I think we're also going to see Ukraintsi fitting into that. Willingness to use violence, less to lose, harder to penetrate for the police authorities, harder to control by the criminal authorities. It's a recipe for rather more mayhem on the streets. And as I said, a fair amount of this is driven by economics. Now, the Afghan war was affordable for the Soviet Union in the long term because it was, you know, as I say, relatively limited. There was a certain amount of money being spent on the war. There was a certain amount of money being spent on certain reconstruction projects in Afghanistan and such like. And obviously, there were also some economic sanctions. But, you know, ultimately, this was not what the real problem was. It was precisely that the Soviet economy was, in any case, in terminal decline. In this case, with Ukraine, on the one hand, look, it's much, much more expensive in terms of the actual war, but also in terms of the impact of sanctions, which it's a long-term thing, but we really mustn't fall victim to the assumption that sanctions don't work. They do work. They just don't work in the way that some of their boosters were suggesting, that it was some kind of magic silver bullet that would end the Russian Federation or Putin's war. So on the one hand, the costs are that much greater. But on the other hand, we also have to recognise the degree to which Russia went into Ukraine in a much, much stronger economic position than the Soviet Union was in 1979, let alone the mid-1980s. So, you know, we shouldn't necessarily think it's going to be exactly the same. But what one can say is that a series of fundamental and systemic weaknesses of the Russian economy are being massively magnified by the impact of the war. So it started in a much higher, stronger position than the Soviet Union, but it's taking a much, much steeper downward curve as a result. And this kind of accelerated entropy, again, it's not necessarily going to bring down the system in itself, but what it does do, just as Afghanistan did for the Soviet regime, is in some ways make the choices harder. It means that you've precisely got less margin, less slack, so that when you're going to have to make decisions, they are going to be much more zero-sum. If you want it, if you need to spend more money on, say, the military, or even on looking after veterans, that money is going to have to come from somewhere else. And if your system is already heavily geared, if you don't actually have the capacity to easily collect more money through taxes or whatever, then it means cuts in other places, and cuts in other places just simply transfer the potential discontent into other causes, other regions. I mean, this was one of the big problems with the Afghan experience in the health system, was when people were saying, no, we need to give the Afghan veterans, you know, proper access to healthcare facilities and such like. The response that came back from the Ministry of Health is, fine, who gets less then? You know, do we then mean that the workers who are suffering from industrial accidents, do we push them to the back of the queue? or whatever else. You know, it's not as though these are going to be costs which do not impact on someone else. So again, this is where I think the war in Ukraine is going to bite the system, but often in unpredictable ways. It'll mean that precisely when suddenly new demands crop up, that will each time create a much sharper political choice. And this is the thing. Putinism, and Putin himself, is not good at making tough decisions of this sort, of making unpopular decisions, of decisions where there is no clear sort of positive outcome. So it tends to lead to paralysis. And I think that's going to be absolutely crucial. The Afghan war was one which actually the Soviet leadership under Gorbachev, they had a pretty good sense of what they wanted to do. Getting there was going to be sometimes difficult. But what they wanted to do was extricate themselves from this war, reduce the political costs, and in some ways use this as a springboard precisely to relaunch their relationship with the West. It was an obvious irritant, not just with the West, actually, but also, it's worth noting, with the Muslim world and with China. And so by pulling out of this war that had been going on long enough that it was almost regarded as a kind of a fixture of the international scene, Gorbachev gained credit. Putin cannot and will not gain credit for pulling out of Ukraine. No one's going to say, well, I mean, yes, he invaded Ukraine in the first place, but full marks for him for pulling out. No, of course not. There's no way he himself can accrue any advantages. Furthermore, he doesn't, I think, really know, have a clear sense of what he wants. I mean, sure, he has a wish list. I'm sure he'd like to see Ukraine neutered and controlled by Moscow, but yeah, that's not going to happen. But so there isn't that sort of clear sense of an outcome which other countries would find acceptable. You know, Afghanistan was fine with actually having the Soviets pull out. Afghanistan's neighbours were quite keen on the Soviets pulling out. And so they had an incentive to basically work with Moscow to find a way of achieving that. Given that Putin will almost certainly want, well, at the very least he would want Crimea, I suspect he would want also the land bridge or any other territories, and also constraints on Ukraine's future. I don't think he's still kind of got his head round the idea of the, you know, a truly sovereign Ukraine making its own choices. Well, in those circumstances, what could Putin seek that other countries would want to encourage him and help him achieve? The answer is none. So I think we're going to see paralysis in terms of the overall political strategy as regards Ukraine. But we're also going to see paralysis at home because of all the tough choices. And all of this is going to serve to exacerbate the existing problems. Again, just like Afghanistan was not crucial for the Soviet Union, but exacerbated and brought to the forefront the deeper systemic problems with the Soviet system. So too, I think, with Ukraine, in terms of Putin's legitimacy, in terms of whether or not he actually does make decent decisions, decisions which are actually genuinely good for the country, in terms of the position of the economy, which by its increasing isolation from much of the global system and the additional costs it's having to bear as a result is grinding down. About a fragmentation of the elite, and indeed a fragmentation of the security apparatus. And here's a last little kind of parallel that I'd want to draw. The fragmentation of the Soviet security elite, the rise of people who were both, you know, extreme conservative nationalists, but also those who wanted to see genuine reform and even democratization. Well, I think that was one of the crucial elements behind not just the decision to have, but also the failure of the 1991 August coup, when a bunch of hardliners thought that they could just isolate Gorbachev, declare in effect that the clock was being rolled back to pre-reform era, and thought that actually they could make that stick on a country which was no longer willing to do so. Had they, in the very first day, been able to demonstrate the kind of ruthless brutality which the Soviet system had in the past, then they might have got away with it. Because in that first day, pretty much everyone, with a few exceptions, was holding their breath and waiting to see. But the point is, they didn't. And they didn't in part because Defense Minister Yazov wasn't willing to be the man who bathed himself in blood for the name of this coup. And indeed, many of the officials within the security apparatus, including the KGB, were opposed to it. You had the bizarre situation of literally on the same floor of the Lubyanka, people plotting moves to support the coup while they were being spied on by others who would then pass on information to Boris Yeltsin, who was the sort of the main figurehead of opposition to the coup. All on one floor of the Lubyanka building. So the fragmentation of the security elite was crucial, I would suggest, to the failure of the 1991 August coup. The thing is, now, in some ways, Putin is in the position of the coup plotters, the so-called Vazmyorka, the Gang of Eight, in that, you know, he's actually trying to hold on to a conservative, I would suggest, retrograde model of the Russian Federation. And precisely it's because of the growing fragmentation of the security elite that is proving less and less convincing. I mean, we'll have to see what the long-term impacts of the Prigozhin mutiny are. But if nothing else, I think it demonstrated that in a vote of confidence in Putin, the security apparatus, in the main, chose to abstain. Well, that's not a secure long-term position for Putin or for the Russian Federation. So we'll have to see. So I think for all of these reasons, you know, it's worth drawing the comparisons between what otherwise look like very, very different kind of wars. But also, Afghanistan proved to be the Soviet Union's last foreign war. There were, you know, warlike examples of internal repression, but not a foreign war. There are those who worry that there could be further foreign wars after Ukraine. I honestly don't see how this system and this president survives this war, or at the very least survives the war with the capacity, political and military, to fight any further wars. So that is a little bit of optimism in its own sense. And as you hopefully know by now, I always like to end my podcasts on an upbeat note. Anyway, as I say, there won't be anything from me for probably about 2 weeks. I will speak to you in due course. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. A stray Russian drone slams into an apartment block in Romania, and in the process offers us a case study in what we could consider the Kremlin's belligerent crisis management, and why Putin's Kremlin is so often its own worst enemy. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow Shadows. This podcast of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Before I start, now, in some ways it's actually a little bit misleading because there were some sort of out-of-sequence specials and so forth, but technically speaking, this is the 250th episode of In Moscow Shadows. I literally only realised that when I was actually saving this file. And so I want to use this opportunity to thank you, all of you who have been listening for whatever length of time it has been. And yeah, well, I just hope that it continues to be of value to people to listen. Anyway, Last week, a Russian Gerantu drone hit a 10-story residential apartment block in the southeastern Romanian city of Galați, causing a fire and injuring two civilians. And this is the first time that a stray drone from the war in Ukraine has hit a densely populated area inside a NATO member state and caused injuries. And I want to look at this episode not so much because it is that pivotal in its own right. I'm not minimising it, especially as it could have been a lot worse. But rather, I want to use it as a case study in how the Kremlin tends to respond to these kind of crises and incidents, and why it seems inevitably to default into such a belligerent mode that actually seems so counterproductive. Now, it's worth noting, I mean, some people have claimed that this actually was a deliberate attack and a probe with the usual claim that it was because Moscow wanted to test NATO. I find this, I have to say, pretty questionable. This was never going to be something that anyone really wanted to elevate. It wasn't going to be the subject of Article 5 discussions, though it might be talked about under Article 4. And in any case, this whole testing NATO line seems frankly to be a Western rather than a Russian obsession. Indeed, it's much more likely that, as the Romanian government says, this was a strike aimed at the Ukrainian port of Reni, which is just on the other side of the Danube, that malfunctioned or had its sense of direction scrambled. Apparently it was hit by anti-aircraft fire. And, well, just like, it's worth noting, the Ukrainian drones that have come down in Baltic states were clearly just sort of diverted off track. According to Romanian President Nicuțor Dan, there was a swarm of 43 Russian drones targeting Ukrainian port, you know, Reni, and one of them was hit by exactly anti-aircraft fire, and this sent it spinning off into a different direction. Now, as I say, I'm not minimising this. This is what's going to happen if you insist on launching drone strikes on border targets, and the West is absolutely right to call it reckless and irresponsible. Even though, obviously, some people pushed it rather further, there was a bit of predictable breast-beating from the hawks. But the point is that both Romania and NATO have officially categorised the strike as an accidental spillover from attacks on Ukraine rather than a deliberate act of aggression. But what I'd like to dwell on, as I said, is how this is a case study in just how lead-footed and often, I would say, downright stupid the Kremlin seems to be in a crisis. Because we seem to find the same depressing pattern repeating in terms of its responses every time. First, temporise and hope the issue goes away or is eclipsed by some new news. Which, let's be honest, is a lot more plausible in the Trump era, where we do have a rather ridiculous spin cycle of news. So, for example, speaking at a press conference in Kazakhstan, Putin stated that it was too early to determine whose drone it had been. No one can say what had really happened until there's been a proper formal forensic investigation of the wreckage and so forth. So basically, step one, just try and put it off and hope it goes away. Second, of course, in the current environment, blame the Ukrainians. Putin actually suggested that the drone was likely a Ukrainian one that had strayed off course because of, again, malfunction or electronic warfare. And he compared the situation to previous incidents in Poland and the Baltic states, where the initial sort of panicky reactions have been, oh, the Russians are coming. And it proved to involve Ukrainian hardware, which is perfectly true that that is the case in the Baltic states. But the point is, just because there were some cases of Ukrainian drones going off track doesn't mean it's not Russians. But the point is, it's good to blame the Ukrainians if you're Putin. Once you've done that, well, then you claim that it was essentially an incident that's been manipulated by hawks and blown up simply out of sheer Russophobic ambition. Putin openly mocked, for example, the fact that Ursula von der Leyen of the European Commission had blamed the Russians, saying, well, she hasn't looked at the wreckage herself, has she? And likewise, you know, other Russian coverage has presented the news as, if not an outright fabrication or a false flag, nonetheless, you know, being hyped up well ahead of any hard data. So stage three is just simply saying, oh, hawks are using this for Russophobic purposes. And that allows you to move on to stage four, which is essentially to demand that the anti-Russian case is proven. Maria Zakharova, the ever-toxic spokeswoman of the Foreign Ministry, flatly labelled all European accusations against Russia as baseless and unsubstantiated, claiming that no material facts had been presented. And above all, twinned with this is a sense that, well, if you're going to prove it, you have to involve us in any investigation. This is, for example, what we saw with the whole Skripal case, saying, oh, well, send us your evidence and we will examine it, as if actually the suspects need to be part of the investigation. Of course not. But the point is, this is intended to try and, well, in theory, if this was accepted, give Russia access to any investigation and a chance to spin or delay it. But more to the point, because they know full well that it won't be accepted, it's a chance to say, oh, well, just think of what cover-up is going on. Just think of how, if we were involved, we would see that, in fact, the real story was something very different. And then finally, stage five is, if it has been proven, just tell the other side anyway to shut up or else. And we saw this kind of aggressive approach very, very clearly in one of the usual outlets for such belligerence, because he is at once high enough profile that his words are newsworthy, but on the other hand has no real meaningful position and therefore can be ignored or denied if inconvenient, Dmitry Medvedev, deputy chair of the Security Council, because he took to social media and wrote, shut up. This is just the tip of the iceberg. This will continue to happen. There's a war going on. And citizens of EU countries, like the populations of warring countries, won't be able to sleep peacefully, especially in those places where drone production facilities are located for the Banderite forces, in other words, the Ukrainians. So Medvedev is actually almost leaning into this idea that this was a deliberate strike, which again, I don't think it was, to more or less say, just don't talk about this too much, because who knows where we could hit next. We have seen all this sequence play out so many times before. And when has it actually ever really worked? I mean, as is, if we look at this particular incident, in response to what it called a grave and irresponsible escalation, the Romanian government is closing the Russian consulate in the Black Sea port of Constanța. Meanwhile, Romania has formally requested that NATO speed up the transfer of advanced counter-drone and air defence capabilities so that it can protect its border. Russian drone debris has apparently fallen on Romanian soil 47 times since the 2022 invasion. And, of course, though, this is the most serious case. But at the moment, Romania is spending about 2.8% of its GDP on defence, which is up from 2.3% in recent years. And the plan is to hit 5% by 2032. I mean, they've already ordered, for example, 32 eye-wateringly expensive F-35A jets. But there were concerns about whether or not there was the political will for future expenditure. And I imagine that it's now going to be a lot easier to push through the order, for example, of a third 16-plane F-35 squadron, which is what they were planning. So, you know, all of a sudden, Romania is arming itself rather more assiduously. Meanwhile, it was very hard for the Romanians to actually do anything about this case, because they only had, apparently, 4 minutes between radar detection of the drone and it actually impacting. And so, as a result, NATO is actually beginning to debate or changing its rules of engagement to allow its forces to bring down low-flying drones even before they actually cross into alliance airspace, if they look as if they're posing a direct trajectory risk to civilian cities. So if they're on a dangerous track, then maybe you'd actually shoot them down even while they're over Ukrainian airspace or looking at other areas, international waters. And again, that's a step forward. It's inconvenient for the Russians, to say the least. And it's being pushed forward by not just the drone strike, but how the Russians have chosen to respond. And more broadly, look, Estonia has apparently just installed its first kind of permanent drone detection systems along a little stretch of its border with Russia and plans to extend it to the whole length. Well, I do wonder how long before the Romanians and others want the same. So, as ever, this has been something of a PR disaster for the Russians. I mean, just think, purely as a counterfactual, what would have been different if Moscow had promptly admitted responsibility, saying, yes, yes, it was one of their drones, but it was a terrible accident. Obviously, in the process, they could indirectly blame Ukrainian air defences and electronic warfare. But nonetheless, they say, but, you know, ultimately, it's our drone. We will take responsibility. Offered not just apologies, maybe even compensation, which actually, if nothing else, would have raised some interesting questions about forcing some flexibility over the sanctions. Because if you're going to pay compensation, you have to be able to pay it, which means unlocking some banking stuff. And the point is that every small and temporary hole in the sanctions machinery structure is still a hole. And then maybe even gone further and said, look, they were perfectly happy to observe a moratorium on further strikes on border settlements along the Danube, so long as the Ukrainians observe similar restraint on, say, oil refineries whose damage has terrible environmental effects. You know, let's think of the children. Now, look, of course, this would have been seen for what it was, damage control. But nonetheless, this kind of an approach might have mitigated the worst of the reputational effects for Moscow, and maybe even put some pressure on Kyiv to limit its strikes, for minimal real consequences to Moscow's campaign, because every drone that is not aimed at a Danube port can be aimed somewhere else of equally significant military effectiveness. Now, look, I'm not making a pitch for a crisis management consultancy gig with the Kremlin. I'm just highlighting that it did have options, and I would suggest arguably rather better ones. So why this thuggish, cack-handed, predictable and counterproductive playbook? I don't like this term playbook, that is actually quite widely used when it comes to the Russians, because I think too often it is used to claim or impose a pattern where none exists. But I don't see how that can be avoided this time, because that sequence I've talked about, that range, that limited but nonetheless predictable range of responses and options, is one that we've seen so many times in so many different contexts. Whether we're talking about the MH17 shootdown back in 2014, whether we're talking about, as I mentioned, the Skripal attempted poisoning or whatever else, time and time again we've seen this. So why does Moscow react with such implausible belligerence every damn time? As I say, this particular incident, frankly, is not a really important one. It's likely to be just a footnote in a month's time, unless it's repeated. But the reason I'm actually digging in is I do think this is a case study in the psychology, in the political culture of Putin's Kremlin. So having kind of laid out the situation, after the break, let me go into quite why I think this kind of pattern emerges and why, for the Kremlin, what may to us seem ludicrously counterproductive actually performs a function. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism and civil affairs. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian, get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, including articles I've written, the most weekly Govorit Moskva press briefing, and other bonus content like the Chronicles of a Different Russia alternative histories. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Before I get down to the nitty-gritty, just to mention that on the 23rd of June, I'll be in Potsdam speaking at the Center for Military History and Social Sciences of the German Armed Forces on the topic Autocracy versus Technocracy, explaining the Ukraine war through politics and history. There may be some other gig in Berlin after that week. Watch this space for that. Anyway, back to the topic at hand. Why that particular kind of response that we get time and time again from the Kremlin? Well, first of all, I think the purpose is to maintain the illusion of infallibility at home. This is an issue of autocratic strength. You know, a regime's legitimacy, a regime like this, relies very heavily on projecting not just competence, which, let's be perfectly honest, is often a real problem for this Kremlin, but also absolute power and admitting a mistake, admitting a crime. These are things that the Kremlin tends to regard as a sign of weakness that could embolden both pressure from without, but also domestic political opposition. So there is a natural default towards saying, we do not screw up. And more to the point, this feeds into a certain cult of invulnerability, that the government presents itself to Russian citizens as this unassailable, reliable protector against external threats of any kind, whether we're talking military threats or just simply harsh words. So making admission of guilt in this respect is, again, impossible. I mean, for example, Tsargrad, the ultra-nationalist news outlet, spanned this as some kind of a story of Russian success. The way they have framed it, Romania and NATO made a fuss about some drone strike, who knows quite what it was. And they are, in fact, talking about making some kind of harsh response against Russia. And then that's the point when Dmitry Medvedev, the mighty globe-bestriding colossus that he is, made his intervention on social media and, quote, it was at this moment that the diplomatic magic occurred. For some unknown reason, the NATO Council didn't convene. And in Bucharest, they apparently spent the entire night pondering Medvedev's unpleasant words. And in the morning, they came up with the following. The drone was Russian, but it wasn't treacherous and hadn't attacked at all. It turned out it had been shot down in Ukraine by the same infamous air defence system that sends chills down the spines of Ukrainians. It was shot down and it nosedived straight into Romania. So Russia didn't attack. Well, there is, of course, no evidence at all that Medvedev gave the Romanian government a sleepless night. But the point is, this has been spun now as actually a tale of successful deterrence of NATO that wanted to use this as an excuse for some kind of hostile act. And of course, it also plays in the same, under the same sort of category, into a certain victimhood mentality. You know, the Russian government consistently frames any exposure of its wrongdoing as some kind of evil coordinated Russophobic plot orchestrated by the West. Izvestia, for example, which is often, frankly, a relatively sane Russian newspaper by the standards of the Russian media, nonetheless claims that the Galatsi incident was actually just simply the pretext for a new diplomatic escalation that had been prepared in advance, this closure of this Russian consulate. So the Romanians had been waiting to do it and, no doubt, heaved a sigh of relief when they had a suitable pretext. And this leads away to what we could consider to be preemptive aggression. And this is crucial because it's worth noting, you know, we shouldn't forget that, and I'll come to the information warfare side of things in a moment, but nonetheless, you know, there is an element within Russian strategic culture that says if you're going to get involved in a conflict, best throw the first punch. And I think this is this kind of preemptive aggression, almost defensive aggression that we see here. By treating every accusation against them as an act of Western gibridnaya voina, hybrid warfare, against Russia, of course, the regime justifies its own aggressive, hostile responses as a legitimate act of national self-defense. And in the process, again, not only does it puff itself up as the defender of Russia and Russians, but it also is a massive deterrent to open discussions about failings at home. When you frame yourself as being in an existential political struggle, then, as Putin has made absolutely clear since 2022, there is no more middle ground between being a patriot and being a traitor. And if you start talking about, you know, issues in which the government seems to have done badly, if you start echoing the talking points of the Western media, then you have crossed that line from patriot into traitor, and so you don't. And this is something that we see very sort of generally as a way of trying to close down any internal discussion. It fails in terms of the kitchen table conversations, but it can certainly affect the open discussion. This is also about information warfare abroad. So we got the illusion of infallibility at home and information warfare abroad. much is made at times in certain quarters, this idea that the Kremlin employs a Soviet-era tactic called reflexive control. Now, reflexive control is about conveying information, specially prepared information, to an opponent in such a way as to force them to make a decision to do something which will actually be to their disadvantage. And honestly, I do have a sense that it's another example of a fairly common tactic that everybody uses. I mean, frankly, every parent trying to use reverse psychology to get a kid to eat their greens is, in a way, employing reflexive control. But the point is, this is something that is made to seem exotic and Russian-specific by giving it a particular term. You know, we've seen this with maskirovka for strategic deception and such like. That said, it is certainly true that Russia absolutely does seek to manage narratives in a very purposeful manner in order to undermine its enemies. Essentially, these days it means the West, and also push them in certain directions. And one of the approaches it does so is not by kind of presenting a single coherent line, but quite the opposite, by employing what is called Infoschum, information noise, in which you basically try to deploy multiple, often contradictory lines. Not so much in order to try and convince others of your particular point of view, so much as to muddy the waters, to try and give that sense that, oh, well, we'll never know the truth of it, so let's move on. Again, classic example was precisely what happened in 2014, when Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 was shot down over the Donbass by rebel forces using a Russian-supplied Buk surface-to-air missile. When you had claims that, oh, it was actually a Ukrainian missile, it was actually a Ukrainian plane. I mean, they actually claimed the ground attack aircraft, which couldn't possibly get a sufficient altitude, was responsible. Or even more outre ones, the one I thought was extraordinary, was that it was already full of corpses. And this was a CIA plot to basically bring it down over the Donbass and then claim that the Russians and their local rebel clients were responsible. All kinds of nonsense. But the idea is you just blast out as many different conspiracy theories as possible, not because you think any one of them is going to gain much traction, but just simply by the sheer volume and in some ways the eye-catching lunacy of these lines, that you obscure the truth. And, for example, we had in Komsomolskaya Pravda one Sergei Stankevich claiming, in connection with the recent Romanian attack, the goal is to provoke a major European war, first by drawing in at least one or two more countries, Romania, Moldova, Estonia, Belarus. Everywhere we see a pattern of non-random, quote-unquote, drone incidents. So you make this out to be sort of part of some grand provocation to generate a whole new global war or something like that. And, you know, in so many other areas, the Russians try this. They escalate the situation and they throw out as many different lines as possible in the hope of obscuring the reality, but also maybe one or two of them happen to land. Take, for example, Zelensky. I mean, the Russians have portrayed Zelensky as a drug addict, patron of neo-Nazis, pawn of the United States, pawn of the United Kingdom. Or recently we had this viral AI-driven campaign circulating an entirely fabricated news report claiming that he had just bought a $3.2 million Armani-designed, that's a nice little touch, apartment in the Burj Khalifa, huge building in Dubai, for his mum. I don't know, actually, in some ways, I think, he looks after his mum. Maybe that sounds almost positive. But clearly, this is an attempt to basically paint him as corrupt as well. So in all the other things. So this is the approach. It's information warfare because you want to, I mean, obviously, ideally, you establish yourself as an arbiter, not the suspect. I mean, indeed, Putin had said in relation to the drone strike, if they provide us with some objective data, we will conduct an objective investigation, and only then will we make an assessment. So it's trying to elevate Russia out of the mess. So again, it's not a suspect, it's another investigator. But failing that, you want to make any investigation impossible, or at least implausible, so that when you actually get the real truth, it is buried, hidden under this cloud of falsehoods. And that leads to, I think, the third point I would want to make, is that this is not just simply about trying to respond to a particular piece of bad news. It's also about what we could consider to be asymmetric information deterrence. I know, I'm putting my own little pompous phrase on this. There is a claim often made, again, that Russia has, in its military doctrine, an escalate to de-escalate strategy. So in other words, if it gets involved in an unpleasant conflict, it will actually step up, and often the implication is by using nuclear weapons, in order to de-escalate the situation. So basically, it does something really dramatically bad and then says, we don't want this to get out of hand, so let's agree to settle things down. Well, I think it's very questionable that that's actually part of its military thinking. But on the other hand, it certainly does seem to be how it approaches information warfare. Again, by upping the ante in the hope that everyone will want to just calm things down and make this problem go away. So we always have these very, very aggressive efforts to blame everyone else. I mean, Zakharova, for example, says that this case is actually just a means of trying to distract attention from the Ukrainian drone strike that hit the university premises in Starobielsk, carried out, she adds, with EU money and EU support. This Starobielsk case, after all, is a very live issue for the Russians at the moment. You know, a series of Ukrainian drones hit a couple of educational establishments in Starobielsk in occupied Luhansk. And it seems to have killed 21, I think it is, mainly youngsters. And they're claiming that it was an unprovoked attack on a civilian target. The Ukrainians, well, I mean, at first there was a sort of claim that, oh, no, there were no civilians killed. Now I think they're accepting that there were. But actually they were saying that, in fact, this building was a headquarters of the Rubicon drone unit. Now, the fact of the matter is, hard to ascertain from outside. I think it's fairly clear that civilian kids were killed. On the other hand, two particular separate but adjacent educational institutions were hit. The second one, it's much harder to be sure quite what was going on there. It may well be that that was some kind of military installation, and that the kids were, to use that ghastly expression, collateral damage. They were sort of caught by accident as a result. But the point is, clearly, the death of 20 or so youngsters is not just a genuine tragedy from the Russians' perspective, but also a very, very handy information tool. So that's being brought up time and time again to say, oh, well, it's because Ukraine did this terrible thing that Ukraine and its allies are trying to distract from that. Putin himself, when he was in Kazakhstan, was very, actually quite angry and said, within the media, the Western media, there's been, and this is untrue, but nonetheless his view, not a word at all, simply not a single word about the tragedy in Starobielsk, about the fact that children died, that our children were deliberately killed. Not a word of it, as if it doesn't exist. So, you know, again, we tend to have this thing of just, well, you did something bad. Now, for example, we have Russia still making much of its claim that a Ukrainian drone hit a turbine at the Zaporizhia nuclear plant that they seized. And this is another terrible, again, to use those phrases, you know, reckless and irresponsible act. So if in doubt, if feeling on the defence, move immediately to the offence and respond to accusations with immediate belligerence, with overkill, quite frankly. The idea is to force critics, essentially in this context Western leaders, to weigh the cost of pushing for accountability against the risk of a dangerous confrontation. I mean, this is the purpose of things like Medvedev's broadside. It's just basically to try and say, shut up and do not push this too far, because otherwise you're going to make us do something that you won't like. And it's noteworthy, for example, that after the announcement from Bucharest about the closure of the consulate, The Russian Foreign Ministry, I mean, didn't just simply condemn it as an attempt again to divert international focus from Ukraine's actions in Slaviansk, but warned that there would be a prompt Russian response. I mean, I think Romania still has a consulate in St. Petersburg, so maybe it's time for the staff there to start packing. But again, it's always this point of, if you are going to try and make us accountable, appreciate that we are going to hurt you back. It shifts the conversation away from the original wrongdoing into just simply the tit for tat.